Welcome to episode 20 of the Scuddy Podcast. This episode is the first of a series of episodes on the topic The Greek Crisis, an Odyssey and its Legacy. In this retrospective, we ask why Greece has had more than its fair share of economic turmoil in recent years. We review and discuss the challenges Greece has faced on the road to recovery. On this journey, we ask what lessons we can learn. Join us as we explore the origins and impacts of this financial crisis that has captured the world's attention. We hope you enjoy.
Evaristo Alexandra, to invite me to this exciting podcast about Greece. As you know, I love Greece so much. I'm really looking forward to find out what was really going on over all these years. The understanding I have so far is it was a sovereign debt crisis that came about because of excessive public spending and overlending, a bit of inaccurate reporting perhaps, and economic mismanagement. And I know that the problems escalated over the years as the global economy shrunk and growth slowed down.
Parakalo, Martin, and thank you very much for joining me in this podcast. Indeed, the reasons behind Greece's crisis were the ones you just mentioned. But just to let you know, the Greek debt crisis is not a recent event. The country, since 1960, was facing economic challenges. The expenses of the Greek government exceeded the revenues constantly in a yearly basis. Greece's deficit was not only due to overspending, but also because the country was burdened by repaying existing debt. However, for many years, the debt levels were well managed and relatively low versus to GDP.
In 1974, the ruling military junta collapsed and the exiled former Prime Minister Konstantinos Karamanlis was called to return to Greece from Paris to lead the transition back to democratic rule. They heralded a new era for the Hellenic Republic. The Greek government wanted to bring Greece into the economic mainstream by financing military expenditure, public sector jobs, pensions and other social benefits. Inevitably, though, this resulted in increased deficits for Greece over time. Up to 1980, the country's economy was in a good shape. The deficit was below 3% and the debt-to-GDP ratio appeared stable at around 22%. The Bank of Greece had a plan for debt management, and the plan was to simply print more money, which, as expected, caused inflation. And just like that, slowly, steadily, and almost imperceptibly, through inflation, the government absorbed purchasing power from the citizens and used it to pay off the debt.
Ah, interesting. Our old friend, money printing. Many governments around the world have used extensively over the years.
Exactly. The restoration of democracy helped Greece to become the 10th country to join the European Economic Community in January 1981. This was despite the doubts of some member states that the country was not yet economically mature enough to join the European Community. From 1981 until 1990, Greece's debt to GDP steadily rose. The same money printing technique from the Bank of Greece was used between 1981 to 1993, but the budget deficit had grown by leaps and bounds and the inflation was not enough to consolidate the debt. The debt to GDP by the end of 1989 was tripled. By the beginning of 1990, the Greek government realized that it was time to try a new strategy, austerity. This was a shock to the system for the general public and caused negative reactions throughout the country.
That's really interesting too, especially as we've been accustomed to having, you know, very cheap money and governments printing money for the last decade really, and it's only when interest rates have risen recently over the last 12-15 months, something like that, mm-hmm. that problems start to arise and people start to feel pain. So It's understandable, but it's interesting to find out what was happening in Greece.
In 1992, the 12 members of the European Economic Community signed the Treaty of Maastricht, which established the European Union. apart from the shared foreign policy and shared EU citizenship, the treaty also marked the launch of Economic and Monetary Union, EMU, which paved the way for Euro.
Okay, so 1992 was a very eventful year for many of us, Alex, with the UK, after an almighty battle, famously being forced to withdraw the pound from the ERM. Italy pulled out the lira and Spain devalued the peseta all on a single day. That day became known as Black Wednesday.
Black Wednesday.
Indeed.
So, 1992, what an eventful year. I was born in 1992, and with me the European Union was born when the 12 member states signed the Treaty of Maastricht. And we had like great changes in the European periphery and the European economy. Martin, last time we spoke about Black Wednesday, but can you please explain to me what is exactly Black Wednesday?
Oh, I can. I mean, Black Wednesday refers specifically to the 16th of September, 1992.
Where were you?
Where was I? I'd been trading foreign exchange up until the start of the 90s, and I'd kind of moved on to listed futures and options at that stage. So I wasn't actively trading, but I do remember being fixated by the various headlines coming out of the Reuters terminal on that day when the UK was forced to withdraw the pound from the exchange rate mechanism after many failed attempts to keep it within the set bands that it was signed up to. By raising interest rates and buying pounds wherever they could. Where were you guys
at that
time?
Age, Martin, I definitely wasn't in the markets by then. I was in between school and university. So, I mean, I do remember it, watching it on the telly at home, I think I can recall. But obviously I didn't, I mean, I knew a bit about the markets then, but it was a definite crisis at the time. And you could feel that as rates were just being jacked up and up and up to try and defend it. But yeah, I didn't see it from the markets or terminal perspective. So, what about you, Nick? Were you?
I remember it vividly because it's the closest I came to making my first trade. But I was a student, and the reason for that was that I was sharing a flat at the time with my mate Brian, who was really into mountain biking. And at that time, all the good kit, it probably still does, to be fair, came from the US. And everything, if you bought a mountain bike here, they literally took the US price and just applied the pound price to it here. So you bought a $300 mountain bike in the States, it was 300 quid here. And in the run-up to Black Wednesday, the pound was getting so strong, I remember this, that we were looking at it and going, we should buy some dollars. You know, we were really contemplating buying some dollars, and we just didn't get the opportunity. And of course, I mean, you know, it's all different now with apps and how easy it is to access foreign exchange trading. But if you remember back those days, you had a whopping bid offer spread.
Oh, yeah.
You had to pay commission and you had to basically go down to Travelex and try and deal or whoever, you know, whoever it was. I mean, it was just this is where you made your fortunes, Martin, I'm sure, not in Travelex, but, you know, in the FX market. I mean, it was ridiculous at that point, wasn't it?
It really was.
But do you remember that? Do you remember that in the run-up to it, it was kind of, there was this sort of strengthening, and this is what caused so many problems for people because they just couldn't maintain it. And then when the speculators kind of stepped in and started having a go, then the trouble really began, didn't it? Because what happened at that point?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the UK had initially resisted signing up to the ERM, and the ERM came about as a means to tackle inflation and to reduce volatility in currency fluctuations. And basically, UK didn't sign up until October 1990. And at that point, they fixed the rate as being £1 being equivalent to 2.95 Deutschmarks. And following on from that, all the major currencies within the ERM had a very narrow band where they were allowed to fluctuate by only 2.25%. Apart from Italy, which was allowed to fluctuate up to 6% either side of their entry point. But, you know, it became clear early on that the restrictions around the currency peg were too tight, and lots of countries were struggling to keep their currencies within the preset bands. And you know, I think in the run-up to Black Wednesday, I think the head of the Bundesbank made some rather unhelpful comments about his belief. He seemed to be speaking off record, but
came out with some comments in his, stating his belief that the pound had to devalue, which was not helpful. And within the rules of the ERM, it was the responsibility of all the stronger countries to come to the aid of a weaker currency coming under attack. But unfortunately, as Black Wednesday developed, it became obvious to all that the Bundesbank were not going to step in and help.
That's different from my memory, because I vividly remember the news showing the vaults of the Bank of England, and they were empty, because Lamont spent, and it was Norman Lamont, wasn't it?
I believe
Norman
so.
Lamont spent all the gold, basically, defending the pound. But in fact, and there was a lot of tabloid kind of, you know, oh, you know, we spent all the gold and the Germans were terrible and blah, blah, blah. But I recollect that actually Germany spent far more than the UK did defending the pound on Black Wednesday. So I'm not sure that that's correct.
No,
that's
no.
not how my memory kind of serves me on that. But, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, I wasn't trading at that specific time, but... That's my understanding of it, but yeah, it was an interesting day.
In rates that day, and you've alluded to it, was kind of crazy, and it was at that day, wasn't it? Because there was a kind of intraday move, wasn't it?
And the interest rates, yeah.
I can't remember the numbers, but it went from, let's say, 8 to 10 to 12 to 15.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
Within like 3 hours or something, as they attempted to suck in some sort of.
They were making promises, trying to, you know, just try and shore up the pound, which any way they could, you know, saying, okay, we're going to raise rates from 10% to 12% to 15%. And then, you know, ultimately it failed. And then, and the day after, they were back down to 10%. The market never believed that they were going to keep the rates this high. And rightly so, because the day after they were back down to 10% anyway.
Can you imagine trying to trade gilts? Because those were the moves, weren't they? It was 10 to 12 to 15 and back down to 12,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just, you know, crazy stuff, right? I mean, you've probably seen some volatility in gilts over the years, Dave, but nothing like that.
No, nothing on that scale. You know, and I think even what happened in the autumn, just last year with the mini budget, some of the volatility that was happening there probably can't be compared to what we're talking about now, back in 1992, with those movements in interest rates on the day. Yeah, I can't compare.
But I don't know if, I think it might have been the evening, so I don't know if markets were open. But obviously we had an open outcry market back then, so it would have been different, as in they can gap. They would gap and find a price probably better than they would, under the electronic markets that we see today.
You're such an old school proponent, DT.
Well, I remember the announcement on primetime TV. I think it was about 20 to 8 in the evening, probably BBC One or whatever it was at the time, all channels, I suspect, when, you know, he went on TV and said, you know, we are withdrawing from the ERM 7:40 p.m. that day.
But the other thing that actually strikes me that we probably all forget is that these were political decisions, because the Bank of England wasn't the rate-setting body in the UK at that time. It was the Chancellor.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So it was Lamont, you know, really trying to kind of do what he could.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, I think a lot of the reason why later, you know, and I think it was the Labour government that came in that decided to give the Bank of England its independence to kind of try and give that credibility, because this was obviously very, very damaging for the rate setting process, etc.
Yeah, and I think
I think rates were politically used as tools. I mean, not on that day, but before, you know, there would be a rate cut ahead of an election, etc., because the government could do that. And I think there was a big call for its independence. So, anyway.
And I think on the same day, Italy also came out of the ERM, and they withdrew the lira, and the Spanish devalued the peseta on the same day. And as it turns out, in 1993, the ERM bands were expanded, meaning that currencies could vary by 15% either side of the peg, which is much more realistic, apart from Germany and I think Holland, who were still at the 2.25. Everyone else had, you know, 30% leeway they could mess around with. So I think they realised that it was too strict at the start and it was unsustainable. But
And who but haven't we mentioned in this little interlude about Black Wednesday that we really have to mention?
Soros.
Soros, of course. George Soros. It wouldn't be Black Mesa without mentioning George Soros.
Yeah, and they I think they believe that he might have made somewhere around $1 billion dollars on Black Wednesday, betting against the pound. And the overall cost to the UK is estimated to be some like £3.3 billion in the defence of sterling over that day. But there you go.
Back when a billion meant something as well.
Yeah. You were fairly pleased you were in the office on that day.
The Treaty of Maastricht had fiscal rules all the EU member states were required to meet to enter the EMU and adopt euro as their currency. Rules such as inflation below 1.5%, budget deficit below 3%, and a debt to GDP below 60%. Greece wanted to be part of the EMU and adopt the euro, but failed to meet the required fiscal criteria. But they were not the only ones. In fact, a number of other European countries had spent the 90s trying to find ways to meet the treaty's rules.
Well, I remember, I think it wasn't, if I can say, the usual suspects. I think I think many of the bigger European economies were struggling with the strict treaty rules, and you know, whether it was a revaluation of assets or a different way to structure their debt to make sure they complied with the treaty's rules. You know, a lot of countries were really struggling in that time, and I think Greece along with many others were involved.
So through the rest of the 1990s, Greece continued to work towards meeting the criteria for joining the EMU. Fiscal and economic standards were maintained, such as limiting the budget deficits and government debt. Discipline brought dividends, and a rapid decline in interest rates was observed, which created favorable conditions for the private sector to flourish. Low-cost capital drawn from the banking system flowed into the Greek economy. In the early 2000s, the financial situation appeared better for Greece. In January 2002, Greece adopted the euro. As noted previously, the Treaty of Maastricht set the standards which countries had to achieve to be part of the new currency. In reality, Greece's budget deficit was already well over 3% and its debt-to-GDP level was over 100%. You are probably wondering how Greece managed to get in. The answer? Financial alchemy!
Oh.
In 2001, Greece entered into a currency swap transaction with a Wall Street bank, Goldman Sachs. The deal was structured in a way that helped Greece to reduce the appearance of its debt so it looked as though it complied with EU requirements.
Okay.
Goldman Sachs proposed a currency swap arrangement with Greece. Both parties agreed to exchange cash flows based on the performance of different currencies. The magic in Goldman Sachs' proposal was to convert the debt at historical rates and not the market rates prevailing at that time. This ingenious gimmick from Goldman Sachs helped to reduce the appearance of Greece's debt by around 2.4 billion euros. The deal was legal but confidential.
Okay, yeah.
The annual repayments of this deal were set at 360 million euros plus the inflation and would mature in 2019. And for its overall services, Goldman Sachs received 600 million euros.
Hey, that's a great trade, kid.
That's a great trade, of course.
The swap between Greece and Goldman Sachs received a great criticism because it was perceived as deceptive and unethical. But history shows that those kind of deals were popular. Let's listen to the financial experts of Skadi discussing about this kind of swaps.
So I'm getting very much the sense that a large and an interesting part of this story has been the swap transaction between Goldman Sachs and Greece. And clearly that's something that the Greek press feel very strongly about. But I mean, actually, that's really just a prime example of the kind of financial engineering that banks have been doing for decades and probably will continue to do so.
I think so. It's definitely a deal that's attracted a lot of publicity. Maybe not the biggest one out there, to be honest, because I think around that time, as we all know, you know, many financial institutions were going to corporates and governments offering quite innovative solutions with products and ways to restructure their debt. And I think, it's definitely one that's caught the public imagination in Greece and throughout Europe, really.
Well, I think the difference with the ones that corporates do versus the ones that governments do, governments just have this ability to, you know, maybe this will be controversial, but, you know, really kind of override the rules. Whereas, you know, I think there's things that a corporate just cannot do that a government can do.
Yeah.
And this goes to a heart of a lot of stuff. You know, when you think about when governments sort of, you know, stabilize their currencies, if that was an individual or a corporate doing that, that would be manipulation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and I think they can override stuff. And I think with these transactions, I mean, everyone had a problem, didn't they? There were these, you know, these kind of, it was a political project, and, you know, I guess remains so. You know, I'm a Remainer or whatever, but, you know, the Brexiteers hate it because it's a project and all the rest of it. But yeah, of course it's a project. And, you know, you have these, or they set up these rigorous rules, didn't they, by Maastricht. I'm using the word rigorous, but really it's not really whether it was rigorous or not. It's just they had a rule structure that people then had to wrestle to adhere to. And it's not so easy because we know at that point there was 12 members. There's even more now. And trying to, you know, do a kind of one size fits all where, you know, you have a number of economies that are based around tourism. You've got a whopping economy that's based around, you know, manufacturing and industry. You've got another one that's based around, you know, finance and insurance and so on. These are not similar, you know, beasts, if you like. They're all different. But you also had situations where, I mean, think about it. It's also kind of the era where people woke up to the pensions crisis, didn't they? They woke up to the fact that you've given everyone these kind of final salary pension schemes and that can't work. So there's all kinds of re-engineering going on as people are trying to work out, you know, liabilities and stuff. And then you've also got, you know, in a lot of these countries, kind of quasi-state entities where are they part of the state or are they independent? You know, think about things like KfW in Germany, for example.
Yeah, and I think the post office in Holland or something, you know, things like that, that, well, obviously we had a big raft of privatisation here, but all those companies, all those sort of state, initially state-backed utilities and equivalents were, you know, were on the books or were they off the books or could something be shuffled to kind of go, actually, we can... I think I read that Greece's health system got saddled with loads and loads of sort of debt looking forward and stuff. So, yeah, there's sort of questions around all of that as well, as you say.
Yeah, and it's how do you account for all of those things? What is the look through? Because again, different countries will have different practices and processes, and so on. And my sense was there was an awful lot of, you know, governments doing these deals where they were able to recognise upfront payments, which made things look great. Mm-hmm. And they were effectively allowed to kind of, or able to ignore, you know, the liabilities that were just sort of kicked down the road. Yeah. And that was how they kind of, you know, managed to bring a lot of this stuff into line.
And it wasn't the usual suspects, Nick. I think, you know, you kind of think it is going to be more southern European countries that were mostly active in this. But everybody was really involved, including, you know, the northern states, the Germany, France, Belgium. Everybody was, the rules allowed them to use this financial engineering to their advantage to meet the criteria they had to, and everybody was involved. And then, of course, when major shocks come along, that's when things start to unravel. And
that's exactly right. And you certainly saw that kind of on the corporate side. I mean, we already did a podcast on Enron, but you had examples like Parmalat. And other examples in the kind of corporate space. Lehman was a you know a company that used kind of off balance sheet vehicles to kind of park losses, I suppose you want to say, but you know problematic amounts and so on that kind of allowed them to you know dress up their numbers. There was a lot of this you know culturally happening, and it kind of brings on to another thing really, where you know when I look back at my career. there may well have been sort of, you know, questionable things that have gone on, but really where problems have happened is where you get concentrations of activity and you get kind of feeding frenzies of activities where people just get overzealous with a product, where they've just managed to kind of issue something successfully and then everyone else follows suit around the street and everyone keeps doing it. And eventually you reach a kind of a crescendo in appetite where the buyers can't take any more, and then you're left with these kind of overbalances of stuff, and then problems arise.
Yeah,
and
everyone runs to the exit at the same time.
Exactly, and then everyone then starts looking back and going, oh, well, that was problematic. And it's a really difficult thing. I mean, you pointed out, we were talking about this earlier, Martin, that it's so hard if you're in there at the time to kind of blow the whistle and say, you know, hang on, we've kind of done too much of this, because there's too many, you know, commercial pressures on you, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, not just within your own organisation, if you see deals being done through other houses on the street, you know, it's a pretty close-knit community in the financial centres around the world. People know what's going on. And I think if there's an opportunity there, allowed by the regulations and restrictions at the time to make these kind of transactions, then, you know, it's very hard to be the one putting your hand up to your compliance department or head of product and say, look, you know, this is getting out of hand. You know, we really need to think about not doing so much of this when the opportunity to make so much money is there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a question really for those issuance committees, because obviously new product approval committee, you kind of get there at the very sort of beginning of the pipeline. And you may be the third bank to it, so you're kind of, all right, you're into the pipeline there. But it's really when you've got the product approval and you're on that sort of fifth or sixth issuance committee for a product or that new transaction approval, where you'd hope people are starting to ask the question and go, well, how much more of this can we do? How much more of this should we do? Or, you know, are they asking themselves those kind of questions? Because I wonder if they are. And, I mean, there are other mitigants that people could do. Again, I'm sure they won't want to, but you could reserve P&L. You know, against future problems. But that's, I mean, I remember as a trader, I hate having reserves. You know, no one likes being reserved against because you feel like you've lost the money.
Yeah.
And particularly in this case, if you're reserving stuff for a rainy day, like, i.e. not when you unwind, you know, as a trader, if you're reserved and you unwind stuff, you get that money back. This kind of thing on issuance is a very different kettle of fish. Yeah. You know, you really are putting stuff away for a rainy day and you may feel like you're never seeing that again.
It was all well and good, but a series of unforeseen events caused the deal to turn sour. The 9/11 attack on September 2001 had significant effects on global financial markets. Bond yields plunged, resulting in a big loss for Greece because of the formula Goldman had used to compute the country's debt repayments. By 2005, Greece ended up owning around double the amount of the debt. The amount outstanding had ballooned to 5.1 billion euros. The 9/11 attack wasn't the only unfortunate event. The Enron scandal, leading to its bankruptcy, quickly followed in October 2001.
Oh, we covered Enron in the Scotty podcast, I think it was episode 16.
Exactly. So, the fallout from Enron meant that by 2005, scrutiny increased for all American banks and financial institutions. Regulators saw the need for better transparency, risk management, and compliance with US accounting standards. The US government started to audit all American banks and financial institutions to prevent similar activities in the future.
Okay.
The Greek and Goldman Sachs deal became public in November 2004, when Greece admitted fudging their euro entry. Eyeing the consequences of a US government increasing regulation and the potential for adverse criticism of helping Greece to conceal its debt, Goldman Sachs asked the Greek government to take the transaction back in 2005. The National Bank of Greece bought it for 5.5 billion euros.
Wow, nice trade for Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, of course, it was perfect. After joining the Eurozone, Greece's economy improved a lot. The low inflation and the low interest rates create a stable financial climate that helped long-term lending and in turn, long-term investment. Greece was borrowing at the same rates as Germany. From 2002 until the beginning of the 2008
global financial crisis, Greece's nominal interest rate was 4.5%. Cheap money meant that Greece achieved a big decrease in its borrowing costs, creating additional funds that were available for the economy, enabling strong development and the creation of a new European economy. Striving to maintain a low deficit, the Ministry of Finance in Greece decided to include revenues from the black market. This unconventional move revised GDP and boosted the Greek economy by 25%. This resulted in the Greek deficit falling from 2.1% of GDP to 1.9%.
This is turning into a great story, Alice.
Yeah, dodgy things. During the years 2005 and 2007, the deficit wasn't high and inflation rates were stable and low. Even if those numbers were encouraging, the country was still overspending. The revenues to the government were low, but tax evasion was at its highest. On the face of it, until 2008, the overall financial situation in the country appeared to be good, and no one was mentioning austerity. While many factors are behind the debt crisis, the 2004 Summer Olympic Games in Athens have drawn particular attention. Estimates vary for how much the Olympic Games cost. By any measure, costs overran dramatically and major infrastructure projects were rushed to completion. As an example, Greece is thought to have spent around 1.2 billion euros on security alone. It is often forgotten that the 2004 Olympic Games was one of the first large-scale international events since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Of course, the Olympics didn't cause Greece's financial problems, but certainly added to them. Criticism over the Olympic spending had been sharpened after Parliament launched an investigation into allegations that German industrial giant Siemens AG paid bribes to government officials to secure lucrative contracts for projects before the 2004 Games. The bribes were allegedly paid to gain an unfair advantage and win contracts for various infrastructure and telecommunication projects. The former Greek transport minister has since been charged with money laundering after admitting he had received more than 123,000 euros from Siemens in 1998 as a campaign donation. Olympic officials have insisted the country's financial problems and debt are too high to be blamed on the 2004 Games budget.
So interestingly, from my perspective, when I started working in the city, Greece and Portugal as well were both classed as emerging markets. And actually, Greece, I think they probably moved as a pair, but I think it was in 2000 that they moved to develop market status. And as we're all well aware, that untaps a massive pile of cash in tracking type investments, etc. So you started to see the Greek market really start to motor from then. And obviously, they then had the Olympics coming up in 2004. So the sort of the aberration that happened within that period, not long after they'd become developed markets, was September the 11th.
Yeah, just, I mean, you go about moving stuff. Do you remember, Martin, it was all about GDP per capita, our days in the index.
Yeah, indeed.
I can't remember what the levels were, 12,000, 14,000, I can't remember, dollars per capita. But you're absolutely right. The September the 11th falling when it did meant that really this was the first major kind of global event. You had the Korea-Japan joint World Cup, but the spend for that had already been done. This was the sort of first set of kind of in-process or new spend that was going to happen after September 11th. And, you know, we could do a whole, I think we will do a podcast episode on September the 11th, yeah, and what it was like to trade on that day or be in the markets. And certainly, Dave, you know, settle trades must have been amazing. But just sort of thinking back to, you know, what that actually meant in terms of, you know, them finding themselves sort of having one, you know, a wonderful project like the Olympics, but then, and every, we know at the moment, that, you know, Commonwealth Games for the future is seriously in doubt because the spiral of spending.
And
this was exactly the case with this, wasn't it? There was a spiral of spending, right, for the Greek Olympics.
That's right, and I think
you know, when at times of crisis, governments have to make decisions quickly. And I know that Alexandra told me about the security systems that they felt they had to invest big on, because, as you said, it was the first major, the spotlight of the world would be on them, and they couldn't take any risks of another security flare-up, you know, at the Games. So signing up for expensive security systems that actually were never really deployed, but they panicked. And, you know, and governments do panic at times of crisis, and they don't always make the best spending decisions in that environment.
I know, but also think about what it was like. You know, we come from a kind of era, I know, you know, some of us are older than others, but, you know, a lot of the world that we live in now is the post-September the 11th world, where a lot of the security we experience, just, I mean, okay, we talk about international travel, but thinking about when we go across to Canary Wharf, you know, just whatever it is, 400 yards away, and go and visit, you know, the banks and the customers, getting into a bank so much a result now of what changed on September the 11th. You know, the turnstiles, passes on turnstiles, it was never that. There was a, you know, I remember it was a couple of people on reception. There might have been a security guard kind of nodding you, looking threatening or whatever, or helpful. With me, it was always threatening.
Well, even before you get to the banks, if you look at on the roads and the pavements, all the blocks for cars mounting the pavements, and there's a whole different way of thinking, and risks, you know, have to be evaluated everywhere now. You're right. It's the world we live in.
Yeah, and so it may be hard for people to understand what a change that would be to spend, but it would be massive. Oh. I mean, the way sort of things went up, you know, metal detectors, and, you know, you're holding a bottle of wood, Dave. I'm holding one. You know, you can't take liquids on flights, all that kind of stuff. It's just a different. It really changed the world, that event, didn't it?
It really did.
So it was, you know, and no one's sort of crediting the Greek Olympics for causing the crisis, are they, Alexandra? It's just, it was a kind of, I wouldn't say a straw that broke the camel's back, but it's a big part of the story, isn't it?
It is. So officials that said, like, you know, the Greek debt was way too large to be blamed on the Olympic Games only. But I would say that the country spent a lot of money for this event.
Do Greeks like sport?
Well, they do. We do like sport. I think it was more the pride, because the Olympic Games were born in Greece. So I remember the intro, like, you know, the intro of the Olympic Games. It was a spectacular event, and everybody was, like, you know, shouting, like, welcome home, like, you know, the Olympic Games that came back home. So it was kind of, I think they were aiming in the patriotic kind of feeling of Greeks. I saw a video recently on social media, so, like, no, it's been years, like almost, like I would say 20 years, 19 years since the Greek Olympics, and the event was, like, simply amazing, and everybody was, like, saying, like, no, the Olympic Games came back home. So it was kind of like we were proud as a nation that finally, the Olympics were back. And I'm not going to just say about the Olympics, but we had, like, you know, other major events. It was the Eurovision Song Contest that we won the year after. And then we had to host the Eurovision the following year in Greece. And then you had 2004, the Euro competition, when Greece won against Portugal.
Right.
Oh, my God, what happened? Like, everybody was in the street. We were welcoming the national team. We were spending a lot of money. Yeah.
I get the infrastructure spend on the Olympics, but the other things you're talking about, I would have thought would have been cash generative. I mean, does it cost to put on the Eurovision Song Contest? Maybe I'm too cynical. But certainly, like, winning the football, I mean, that must have been cash generative for the Greek economy, no? I mean, we don't have the numbers, but I just sort of thinking about it. But it's just the difference in that spend on the Olympics itself. And the Olympic Games is always a massive project, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
The spend is huge.
I'm not too sure about Eurovision, to be honest. I have been aware over the years that I think some countries that have won it on a few occasions have kind of can somebody else host it? Because
it was the first time that we won the Eurovision Song Contest. Okay. So you think that would let another country host it? No, we were way too proud to host the Eurovision Song Contest as well. And it was more like money to spend, like for the event.
On bazookies.
Bazookies.
Sorry.
But I would say that between 2001 and 2007, like we were, it's an expression saying like, you know, we were eating with golden spoons. We didn't think of how Greece would be like, you know, by the end of the decade.
Yeah.
Like we didn't care about that. We were so happy.
Yeah.
Like we were a happy nation.
It does sound like a golden era.
It was a golden era. Like how they were calling it the financial euphoria.
Yeah.
So yes, we were in a financial euphoria.
Greece wasn't the only sinner. Until 2008, European Union accounting rules allowed member states to manage their debts with so-called off-market rates in swaps, pushed by the Wall Street banks. Italy, Belgium, France, Germany and Spain were among other Eurozone countries taking advantage of the accounting loopholes. Swap transactions allowed sovereigns to buy the currency at historical rates, which was lowered and recorded debt for statistical purposes at the stronger market rate, in this way making the debt look smaller. These trades were not illegal. However, Eurostat banned this way of registering debt in 2008. In 2008, the United States subprime mortgage market collapsed. The United States-centered crisis ultimately triggered a chain reaction in the financial market, creating a global banking crisis and credit crunch that lasted throughout 2009. Many institutions failed, including global financial giant Lehman Brothers. This prompted government bailouts of banks in the United States and Europe. As borrowing costs increased and financing dried up, Greece was unable to cope with its mounting debt. In 2009, the new Greek government revealed that the country's budget deficit would exceed the 13% of GDP, nearly double original estimates. The figure was later revised upwards to 15%. As for debt to GDP, the estimate was 115%, but later the revised figure reached up to 127%. In late 2009, Fitch downgraded Greece from A- to BBB+. While still investment grade, this marked the first time in 10 years the country had been below an A rating. In early 2010, Moody's downgraded the country's sovereign debt to junk. Other rating agencies followed suit. This prompted Greece's borrowing costs to spike. The credit rating agencies had been criticized for being behind the curve during the 2008 global financial crisis, and there was some criticism that they had maintained a benign outlook on Greece. It was 23rd of April 2010 when the Prime Minister formally requested an initial international bailout for Greece. The European Union, the European Central Bank, and the IMF all had to consider whether they would or even could participate in a bailout. You've been listening to the Skadi podcast. This episode was the first part of a series of episodes on the topic The Greek Crisis and Odyssey and its Legacy. Join us for part two, where we will discuss the gripping tale of Greece's bailout programs. On the discussion panel today was Nick Corey, Damian Taylor, Martin Anthony and David Bridges, with research and interviews carried out by me, Alexandra Mexi. If you want to listen to more episodes, just find us by searching the Skadi podcast on any streaming platform. Feel free to connect to us at Skadi Limited on LinkedIn to read about our research and business relation to anti-financial crime and control functions. Until next time, σας ευχαριστούμε για την ακρόαση.